I'm a really big fan of, especially early on, when you asked about MVPs, is that you are just very close to each of your customers and you talk to them often. It's that concierge MVP that you put the white glove service on, because those are those qualitative things that you may not be able to get from a survey. That is what you want to do when you're first starting, is to get really close to the beat of the customer.
Hello, I'm Steve Klass with the business breakthrough you've been waiting for. We're here taking service businesses to $1 million and beyond. Let's see what kind of impact the next 30 minutes will have on your life and your business.
How's it going, everyone? Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to another episode of Success with Klass. I am so pumped with today's guest. You guys have no idea. So for those of you who have been listening, I was recently on a reality TV show called The Blocks. And think of it as Shark Tank meets The Apprentice. And that's the general thesis of it. But we're given a panel of judges. And there's one judge, not to knock anyone else, but the resounding feedback was that he was the GOAT, the greatest of all time. He was such a persona, so vested in what he was doing. And I think it really speaks to his outstanding communication skills. I've honestly have never seen before. He is a serial entrepreneur. He's done eight-figure exits in the tech realm, recruitment, you name it. He's dabbled in those industries. I am so privileged and honored to have Alex Golimski. I just definitely mispronounced that last name, even though we just went over it, here to join us. It is truly my honor, Alex. Thank you so much for joining us.
Steve, listen, the honor is all mine. I am super excited to be here. When we met on The Blocks, like, I think we instantly had a kinship over here too. So I'm just excited to continue the conversation that we've had.
Absolutely, man. And one of the amazing characteristics that you have is that you shared your failures. It's almost like your life reads like a Frank Sinatra song, where it's like, I've been up and over and down and out, a pawn and a king. And it's amazing to see your success story. I know it's not an overnight success. So I would love to kind of peel back the onion a little bit here and learn a little bit more about your past, especially for the entrepreneurs that are listening here. I assume, and I know this for a fact, that you weren't an overnight success. So walk us back a little bit. So I assume you had a corporate 9-to-5 job before you left into entrepreneurship. And what led you to have that leap of faith?
Let me start back here. I was born in Ukraine at 4 years old to move to the United States. And so I have like the American dream story, truly. Like, we came here, I was one of four kids from Ukraine. We had two suitcases and $50 American and didn't even speak any English. And so we grew up on welfare for my entire life. And so I was moved out at 18. And I did do corporate. I did project management and IT stuff for a good while. But at 28, I started doing my own consulting because I started trying to, it occurred to me that I'm going to be capped with a ceiling. And for me to change my family legacy, to get out of poverty, because I was still not, wealthier, even after I moved out, even at 28, like, we're not well-to-do at all. And so, yeah, I made a really big focus of like, okay, I'm going to move to become an entrepreneur. And in my mind, I thought I had the right expectation of it's going to be really hard for 3 or 5 years. It was hard for a lot longer than that, that we can get into it. I'm a slow learner, apparently. But yeah, the corporate gig was really cool and it set me up with a lot of skills. But then I moved from project management in the corporate world to project management as a consultant. Before long, I wanted to really move up and like build something that actually had like some eternal value and longevity for it too. So I started the startups.
So let's speak about a little bit about that immigrant mentality, because my mother was from Morocco. And do you think that spurns you to become an entrepreneur, where you like you saw what it was like living on welfare and obviously you wanted a better life from then? I mean, what would you say that played into your journey?
You know, it's interesting. I think it's the immigrant story is definitely important because it is a part of you feeling a little bit on the sideline. You don't feel like you're part of the culture. You feel like you're on the outside of the culture, especially if you don't speak the language. And for much of my, youth, where you're trying to structure your ideas and philosophies of the world, I was both an immigrant and poor at school. And so, yeah, it kind of put a chip on my shoulder. And what that allowed me to do is, even as I was like going through, I was very keenly aware that I was poor. I was very keenly aware that I didn't have like the American football jock kind of upbringing. I was a nerd and a geek growing up for it. And I think that chip on my shoulder, to be frank, was a very selfish desire to prove myself. And that is a lot of times how people start, and that's the impetus to get started. I think over time, I've replaced that with, instead of striving to prove myself, to create a bigger calling on my life for two. But I have to admit, like, being an immigrant, I think gave me a competitive advantage because I felt like I had to do more work and push further and harder than anybody else just to get to the same spot.
Yeah, that makes total sense. You know, I was bullied severely when I was in high school. So for me, I was like the nerd Dungeons and Dragons, World of Warcraft type of kid. And
yeah.
There you go. and you know, I never really fit in a way. And I set out to be an entrepreneur almost to prove some imaginary foe wrong. So I'm glad to hear that there's a little bit of kinship there where it seems like you had that urge to prove to yourself, I think, that you're capable of greatness, so to speak. So walk me through the first leap of faith into your first venture. What was that like? I mean, did you have capital of your own that you were investing in it? Like, what was the early days of kind of this startup?
So life back in 2013, I was still doing project management consulting, but I had a good friend of ours that we both used to be headhunters, recruiters in the technical world. And so we created what we thought was a very innovative company at the time. It was a horrible idea. I'll get into that why. But like, we basically said the resume was really a small part of the overall hiring experience and the qualification for it. And so why is that like the main thing? And so we created kind of a matching platform that matched the culture and the compensation that a company offered with the character and competencies of an individual. And it kind of did this eHarmony matching thing. So we had been doing that nights and weekends for almost a year. And what that means is we had full-time jobs. And I lived in Tulsa. I worked and commuted to Oklahoma City. That's about an hour and a half away, 4 days a week. And then on the weekends is when we leaned in and started working on this. And over the course of a year, this is our first time running at it. So obviously much faster now, but we built our first MVP. It was an Excel spreadsheet, actually. We didn't build a custom software. We built an MVP in an Excel spreadsheet, a minimal viable product to test out. And then we jumped too early. We jumped when we got our first customer. Huh. And that was, for us, an indication that, oh, shit, we're on the right track. Like, let's go. And it wasn't. It was not that at all. And
also,
so I had invested, I had invested $45,000 of my own money, which is just from like real estate ventures that I've been slowly building up. Like every time I moved out of a house, we kept that house and rented it out. And we blew through that for salaries for the dumbest reasons within the first couple of months. And we were in struggle mode for the next like year and change.
Wow. So let's kind of double down on the methodology of a lean startup here. So you had $45,000 that you said you wasted away, so to speak, or had false assumptions. What can an entrepreneur do to kind of beta test a product, even if they have a client who's willing to pay them money, based on the lesson you learned there that like, hey, just because we have one client doesn't mean this is going to be a smashing success here. So what kind of elements would you now impose based on the lessons learned there?
I think it depends on what you're tracking as a metric. And we were naive. And so we tracked what the lean startup methodology would call vanity metrics, things that don't actually matter, but can make you feel really good doing it, like website views, right? Heck, even customers in our case was a, I'll explain why. Customers was a bad vanity metric for us because we were able to get some customers on, but we bled them out. And we use the customer onboarding numbers of like, hey, we're increasing, we're adding people, we're doing sales for it, almost to like blind us towards the bigger problem, which is that we had a leaky bucket. And so to answer your question directly, if like the way we do it now is we hone in on what is the most key piece of feedback or metric that is indicative of a client getting really good value for it. Right? And that may be repeat usage, that may be referrals, that may be surveys, that could be a couple other things. But the more closely associated to the kernel of value of your product or service that you're giving, you want to have a metric there. And so your audience has a lot of service-based businesses, right? There's a net promoter score, which is a pretty good way to do that. That has a lot of like science that says that you're not getting eights, nines, and tens if people aren't actually referring you. And so that could be a good one. But to be frank, I'm a really big fan of, especially early on, when you asked about MVPs, is that you are just very close to each of your customers. And you talk to them often. You ask them what
over-deliver.
And Yes, exactly. It's that concierge MVP that you put the white glove service on, because those are those qualitative things that you may not be able to get from a servant, right? That is what you want to do when you're first starting, is to get really close to the beat of the customer.
So you mentioned that you had this first customer and then it kind of went off the rails a little bit and you're maybe hanging on longer than you should have. What did that look like when this is running? Was it just yourself and I believe your brother at the time running it, or did you have multiple employees who counted on you for some payroll? Like, let's talk about some of the dark days there of this startup. Let's get nitty gritty. Yeah.
Well, I'm gonna give you a landscape of some of the dark and some of the overview, so then I'll let you choose to jump into it. So that first company was in 2014. We jumped full time. It was Job Pack. It was that marketplace for hiring. That one spun out and failed again fairly quickly, about a year and change for it. And thankfully, we didn't have employees. It was just me, my brother, co-founder, and then a good friend of mine at the time in Tuna. We were all three co-founders. We were all willing to, you know, hustle and go without salaries. So thankfully, like, it had a real cost, but it was just localized to just the idiots that were running the company, actually. Yeah. So we went from that, though, and we had heard enough feedback saying, hey, your matching thing's cool, but I don't even know how to find the clients or the candidates run through your matching algorithm for it, right? That's my problem, is sourcing candidates. And so we pivoted there to a company called Hire360. And that one was freaking cool, Steve. That one, we basically took the most common process of putting out like a job posting and getting candidates to apply for it. That is the bread and butter for it, but it sucks. You're only skimming the people who are active or looking, and a lot of them aren't the great people you want to. So we created an engine that, this is our first bit of machine learning and jumping into the AI space, that can read job descriptions that people will just post, create kind of this multi-federated search that checks like LinkedIn and Monster and Indeed, finds resumes that match, ranks them, and then even reaches out to them with an email saying, hey, I'm so-and-so hiring manager. I found your resume on this place for you. So it was actually a really innovative.
And this is years ago. This is pre-ChatGPT. So you're really ahead of the curve when this was launching.
Correct. Yeah. So that one did much better. And we did put on some big names. We got Walmart and Uber and Lyft and United Healthcare. We got Affleck. We got some huge names, marquee names for it too. And they used it really well. But we made almost the same problem. We moved their vanity metric to be the customer, to be how many hires they got out of the platform, which was closer. But the problem was that eventually, like, we ran out of candidates. We didn't raise money. We didn't have enough of a bank. And we were buying, by the way, these resumes. And so we kind of were doing this arbitrage of buying resumes.
Mm. Almost a self-validation. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that one was pretty rough. And we onboarded 2017. We had onboarded 65 clients. These are thousands of dollars a month clients. So they're not low figures for two. And we lost 65 clients in the same year.
So great retention. Yeah.
Phenomenal, right? Yeah. That one really hurt. And that was also the year you want to talk about dark. Like, we now have been starving for a couple of years. I was on welfare in 2017. I made like $5,600 on my tax return. Our family income in 2017.
And you mentioned family. So at that time, you were married and had children?
Yeah, I had a small 1.5 or 2 year old at that time, and my wife, and we've been married for, you know, at that time, like 15 years.
So that must have weighed heavy, man, when you had to like kind of call it quits and, you know, I got $5,000 to my name type of thing with I assume some debt owed to some investors or other people.
Yeah, well, so that you bring up a really good point. We had raised on the second round, the second company, Hire360, we had raised $130,000 of friends and family money. And that's in addition to me taking a second mortgage out of my house and putting that money into it. It was crazy invested. And we lost it. We lost it over 2.5 years this time. But eventually, like, we had to shut it down. It became clear that we didn't have, like, we didn't fix our leaky bucket. And so it was honestly through the grace of God, we got a referral to another individual there that was wanting to build another software. And so we've been building software for ourselves. We flipped it to build software and products for other people. And we had learned so much during the journey of making all the mistakes, doing everything the hard way. Right. Yeah, we did really good there. And in the first 6 months, we got about $486,000. So about $500,000 in our first 6 months of operation.
That's amazing.
Huge godsend. Yep. And then by the end of the first year, we had connected to he's probably a billionaire. He owns like 60 companies majority interest in those companies. And he basically made us an offer we can't refuse and bought our company and sold us into another company to run. And that was another journey that we ran into.
No kidding, man. So that's amazing that you didn't. So for me, like, I always consider, if I'm going through a dark place, I'm like, man, what if I just call it quits and just go back to corporate America? And I know I can, my skill set, I can get a six-figure job. But was that ever an option for you? Or did you feel like, hey, I know I'm in a dark place right now, but I know if I just don't quit and I just kind of keep going forward before this godsend came, did you have the moments of kind of throwing the towel before this happened?
Honestly, this is where we dovetail into some really dark, like, mental health stuff. I did not, and I should have, to be probably frank with you, right? But I had this, when I say chip on my shoulder, that's too light of a word. I had this deep feeling of inadequacy and deep feeling of proving myself. And for me to walk away with a failed business and say, cool, that was my shot, it felt like an indictment on me as a person. And that's so dumb to say. I've healed a lot since then, and it's almost like, jarring for me to like recount where my mind was at. But no, I was not going to leave without me finding some level of success. And that level of determination sounds really admirable, but it put me down into a very dark spot. Because even when our company got acquired, I was still in that mindset of like, okay, we got acquired, but it was an acqui-hire. It was $1 million worth of equity that it all rolled over to the next company, basically. And we had to make that one work. And so my acquisition, I had an asterisk next to it. And I, even then, was not considering myself any manner of success. I was now proving myself in a bigger arena. I had 50 employees and contractors. I was running a multi-million-dollar company now. And yet, I was struggling and unwilling to let go even then. And it walked me through a really dark spot where I was like waiting to get hit by a bus almost.
Wow. That's, thank you for sharing that, man. I've unfortunately, I'm all too familiar with that kind of pain where it's like you burn the boats, but you don't want to turn into Captain Ahab of Moby Dick where your mission statement kills everyone around you.
Yeah.
So I think there's a fine line between determination and fatalism. So it's important to anyone who's listening to kind of find that balance, so to speak. And I hate to use a cliche word like balance, but making sure that your mission statement, you're not going down with the ship, so to speak, where like there's a chance of recovery here.
You know, that's such a good point, because you kind of have to keep the main thing here. And I had started on this journey espousing that I wanted to change my family legacy. I wanted to get out of poverty. I wanted to, and not just my nuclear family with like my son, daughter, wife. I wanted to get my broader Golomievsky family like out of poverty. I hired my brother, I hired my sister, like we hired my brother-in-law. Like I was really focused on that. But that's what I espoused. But when it came to a point where like I could make an exit and I was more comfortable and I was making a salary, I still actually felt like a failure. I still felt like I was trying to prove myself. And that caused a lot of harm, both to my personal health, my mental health, my relationship health. So I alienated myself from a lot of people who would have helped. And here's where the lesson is in it, right? I do think that I could have not necessarily done both. I do think the focus on the startup is so key, because you have to throw hours at the problem because you just don't know how to solve it. And so you're making it up and making up for it by just throwing crazy amounts of hours. But I also didn't seek actual help. I didn't seek coaches. I didn't seek mentors. I did it myself in a very true way. And it didn't have to be that hard. And I made it that hard.
I can double down on what you said there, because I had an exit a few months ago. And it took me up until last month to get off a depression almost, where I had a six-figure exit. Nothing, you know, not life-changing money, but decent enough where I should have been proud of what I did. But I felt like a failure, like I gave up in a way. And it's tough to hear that. And it seems like it's like a first world problem to have. But I was very much like, man, why couldn't I get this to work? We're to the point where I had to exit. And I had to exit because of my mental health. Like it was just too much at the time. So, I mean, it can run you ragged. And I love the fact that you said that you were doing it alone. And now you've changed your trajectory, because I was on an island. I had no one to speak to. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs can feel that way. which is one of the reasons I think the blocks was for me was a life-changing event. This is the first time I was ever in a room with that many entrepreneurs who just got it, right? So it, was that how you got out of that valley? Was you just started like, hey, I need, even though you got acquired, you were still kind of put in charge of running the business, making sure it was a success with that little asterisk next to your name. Did you start getting mentors? Like, speak to a little bit about how you got out of that rut, I would say.
Okay, yeah. There's a meme that I like to share, which is the Dos Equis guy, the most interesting man in the world.
Yeah.
You know, I don't always drink beer, but when I do, it's Dos Equis. You may have seen that on Facebook. I don't always learn my lesson, but when I do, you can bet it was the hard one.
Yeah.
I did not learn that lesson until we sold the company that was a turnaround job. Let me dive into that one. So that one, when we got acquired the first time, I became CEO of a 50-person CRM company in a very niche industry for it too. And it was a turnaround opportunity in that it's a 20-year-old company. It's been a software company for a long time, but it was losing like six figures a month in revenue or in profit, right? It was in the hole. And when I jumped into that, I had to, there's a lot of things, and I don't know what level of detail to unpack here, but I'll give you the short and sweet version of it. The platform itself was this huge monolithic platform that was old, outdated, and went down all the time, but it had huge customers on it, like $35 million a month's worth of e-commerce running through this platform that I had, right? And so I had to rework and rebuild a lot of the platforms, and that's kind of like, in this specific case, it felt like doing work on an aircraft still in the air. And it was, every mistake was like magnified for it too. And I didn't get help, honestly. Over the 2 years' time, we had solved not all the problems, but a decent chunk of the problems, at least the most severe ones. I had a customer who was responsible for 85% of the revenue who in the first like couple weeks was like, hey, I'm done with this. I'm out, which would have cratered my company that I just took over. And I got them to sign on for a year and then another year, and we solved enough problems. And I had turned over about 80% of the staff. I had removed legacy products for it too, simplified like drastically, shut down whole teams. I had to do a lot there. I was the bad guy, basically, doing all the things I needed to. And really sucky to be in that position. I mentioned it before, but like there were mornings where I cried in the shower until it got cold, which was my indication that I probably need to get up and go to work for it. It was really difficult. And only when, at the end of that 2 years, when I talked to a coach, a executive coach that actually acted more as a counselor for me, I started working with her a couple months before, and eventually I confided in her like how dark my inner dialogue was and how I was like really waiting to get hit by a bus. It was just a no-win situation that she told me that, hey, you need to talk to somebody. And when I talked to my wife about it, I was like, yeah, I'd never kill myself. I would never do this here. I love you guys too much. And at the time I was doing a lot of drinking, and my wife had the presence of mind and wisdom to say like, do you think that everybody who kills themselves wasn't sober? And so that was my jarring awakening. That was the realization of like, okay, I am literally on a path that I'm a suicide risk because I'm not willing to leave here a failure. Everything's still hard. It isn't going well. And I reached out to a few people. My business partner and investor had the grace of mind to say, hey, you're going to kill yourself. Let's just sell the business. And so they sold the business. I went along for the ride and I benefited from it. But honestly, it was a very difficult process, even with that. It took me a couple, maybe years, honestly, after that to like really get my head on right.
How much support would you say your wife and your kids were at this time? Do you feel like it would have even gotten darker if they weren't around?
Yeah. I don't know. I can say this without hyperbole. I'm pretty sure I wouldn't be around without my wife now too, for sure. Again, that's where the support, the mistake that, again, we're all kind of talking around, is that you feel like you're an island, but you let yourself be on an island, right? You continue to, you don't solve the problem because it isn't the most urgent problem. You know, you have other fires to do, but that is one of the most important things you can do, is set up a support system, get coaches, get mentors. You don't have enough time, social capital, or mental health to make all the mistakes yourself.
It's absolutely the truth. And I urge anyone who feels like they're doing it alone to that you don't have to. There's many support groups that even it could be men only, it could be business oriented, it could be relationship, whatever it is, you know, don't feel like you need to get the help. Like when it gets that dark, just always be surrounded by that community and you won't feel like you're ever alone.
I think that's super astute, Steve. You want to set up the support structure before you need it. I found that I needed it and I hadn't kept up with my community and I didn't have a lot of people to reach out to. And that was doubly, you know, dangerous.
For sure. So let's go back to, you mentioned you had to kind of fix the aircraft as you were flying and rebuild it. So being applicable to say service-based entrepreneurs, if they acquire a business that's maybe doing $1 million a year and they're looking to revamp it, or they're building out their team initially, when you kind of had to rebuild here, what character traits did you look for when you were in the hiring process? Because I know your background is very much in recruitment. And how did you reimagine the company culture on that journey so it was very vision-focused, so to speak? Walk us through a little bit of that, those steps.
God, I love that question. That is such a good question. So culture is super important to me, but culture has a bad rap of being too nebulous and foo-foo for it too. But here's the truth of it. All organizations are top-down phenomena. They are, whoever the leader at the top is going to effectively set the tone for the culture. But there are things that you can and should do as a leader to be intentionally setting the culture. Because basically my first thing is top-down phenomenon. You will always have a culture in your company. You just may not have one on purpose. And if you don't have one on purpose, then even though it's nebulous, it is one of the big differences between a good company and a great company. There's a book called The Advantage by Patrick Lencioni. And it's a really good short book. Talks about how Fortune 500 companies and small business startups have effectively same access to the same tools and information and knowledge, and somewhat to, you know, you can argue it's harder with employees and same access to talent. And so the differences between one company and another now isn't going to be them adding more lean processes. It's going to be how they galvanize and tap into the right people and out compete everybody else. And so when you're first building a company, I am a huge fan of, like, your first couple hires are so pivotal because there are employees, you'll be telling them, but also they're going to help set the tone for who else you bring in. They're going to be the one you rely on most. And so when you start talking about hiring, you really need to find, especially early, you need to find people with attributes that make sense for your service-based business. And the way I generally do that, let me get concrete, is that you think about in terms of who you want to hire. And I do two things. I first say, what is the most critical thing that they need to be able to do? And I'll get back to that. And then I say, what is the biggest risk that this person has? And between those two things, I'll have a couple of things. Like if it's a service-based consulting business, one of the things maybe is being able to push back on clients and don't just take orders, but be a true consultant. And so you take maybe that as like a key piece of like value for it, and you turn that into an interview question, but you don't ask hypotheticals, you ask historicals. And what that means is you don't ask, hey, what would you do if a client was pushing back on an offering for it too, and they want this offering, but you don't think it was that isn't the right solution for them? That's a hypothetical question. People do terrible jobs thinking through like what they'll do. You want to ask historical questions and say, tell me about a time in your background where a customer asked for a product or service that wasn't good for them and how you navigated that. Those are how you start getting your idea of what kind of person it belongs there and how you actually vet to make sure you get that person. And I'll make one more thing. There's a lot to unpack here, but I want to say one more thing too. One of the biggest mistakes that I say everybody makes, but small business owners, because they oftentimes have the least amount of like experience hiring and interviewing, one of the biggest mistakes that they make is they are polite instead of kind. And politeness and kindness are different. A politeness in a social interaction is maybe not telling you have a booger in your nose, or not saying, I didn't understand the question, or to say, I don't think you answered the question. Oh, I'm sorry. The polite thing is not to tell you that and to like ignore it and move on. The kind thing to do is to lean into sometimes the awkward pieces and make sure that you drill in and you're asking questions deep enough that you have confidence that either do have that quality or they don't. And if you don't drive past levels of awkwardness of saying, hey, I don't think you answered the question the way I wanted to. Let me ask it again. Hey, I still don't think you're understanding. Here's an example of what I want. You want to drill in really deep because you don't want to leave that question or that attribute that you're saying is really important. You don't want to leave from that topic before you're confident that they do or don't have it. At the end of the interview, you should be as confident as you possibly can in an interview that they are either the exact person for the role or they aren't going to be a good fit. And if you're leaving ambiguity on the table or uncertainty, or you have kind of the shrug of like, yeah, I'm sure they can do the job, you're doing the polite thing and not digging in and being, you know, sometimes uncomfortable with your questioning, and you're likely going to fire them 3 or 6 months later. And that's
which
not
is way worse in that situation where someone's vested in you and you have to let them go due to performance, as opposed to just being kind upfront with expectations and knowing someone.
Yeah. And know this, it is your job as the interviewer. It is your job as the entrepreneur, as a small business owner, to determine if they are or aren't qualified. They aren't qualified to tell you that I'm qualified for the job. They can, they can connect dots for you, but they don't know the role. They don't know your company. They don't know where you're going. They don't know any of the context that you have. And so you're the one that has to make a very objective opinion on, I do or don't think that you're actually going to be great here. It's particularly scary with salespeople, because good salespeople can sell themselves. Great salespeople can sell your product. And so if the salesperson is just selling themselves for it, you kind of have to put that aside and say, great, let's make sure you can actually
let's get
the service. Exactly.
So if I'm hearing this correctly, you're hiring people based on their attributes and character traits. Obviously you want a skill level so they can, if you hire a web developer, they have to know some web development skills, right? But how much would you weigh skill versus character traits? What would you say is the most important? Like, if someone is a killer salesperson, but maybe not, their emotional EQ is maybe just not there, would you take that person over someone who's got great emotional EQ, but doesn't really know the product? I'm just curious to see what your thought basis on that is.
Yeah, that's a really good question. It depends on the role, because I used to think that A players for everything. Don't make allowances. If you're going to make a shrug hire, you're making a mistake. But to be honest, as you scale and grow, it's really hard to do. And so kind of my philosophy now is that the culture and character of the individual is black and white, binary, yes or no. If they're in positions of influence or hiring or leadership or anything like that, if they have if they're an influential role, I will, whether they're qualified, even if they're crazy qualified, I will reject them and move on to find somebody who can actually build the culture for it. And again, I'll give them very quickly. I touch on this. Culture is nebulous, but in the market vision company that I took over and the 50 employees, it was super jaded, very distrusting, very dysfunctional environment. And the number one reason why I fired employees isn't because they didn't do their job, it's because they weren't a culture fit. And that's brutally hard to do, because you're oftentimes talking about people who are doing an adequate job, and I still find it, because what I was looking for is a environment of high ownership, high autonomy, and high empowerment, because I don't want to micromanage you, and I want to find people who don't want to be micromanaged. And if I have to tell you what your job is or solve problems for you, you're not the type of person that I want to have over here too. And so that is the key piece, where the type of person really think it matters. And I would argue it's kind of almost a go, no go before you even get into the technical. And the interview questions that I mentioned, you can make those technical, and you should make them technical. Tell me about a time where you onboarded a customer and did a full implementation with, you know, a small team, for instance, right? Those are potentially technical questions that are worthwhile. Or on a sales side, right? Tell me about a time that you have a very complicated sales cycle, 9-month sales cycle, how you navigated that.
No, that's excellent. And, you know, there's something I've noted when, as a communicator, and I know it was periphery, because I would observe your communication. And I think you, I don't know if you do it intentionally or innately. I like to think it's a bit of both, but you lead, and I'm sure you do this in interviews, and this is probably why you make an excellent thought leader and leader of an organization. You always start a sentence with, I'm curious about, tell me more, help me understand, and expand upon that. And then I noticed that you're mirroring a lot of the language to make sure that you're on the same page. Like, oh, this is how you implemented this client on XYZ company. Like that must have been really challenging. Let's dive in. So you're kind of replicating that you're understanding it And I think that what leads with empathy and people like, this guy gets it. I want to be part of this organization. And it'll attract the A players to your team as well when you do this. So I don't, I'm curious, is that intentional that you worked it out? Or is this the years of honing, sharpening the axe, so to speak?
It is both. It has now become much more automatic, but it was a very intentional exercise for me. And what I noticed is that when people were nervous in interviews, they would clam up. I wouldn't get to see the real them. And therefore, I had a harder time judging if they were or were not a good fit. And so what I started to do is a lot of head nodding, a lot of positive affirmations, a lot of encouragement, and, you know, making them feel very, very comfortable for it to be able to get as natural thought or philosophy, you know, out of them as possible for it too.
That's fantastic. And I think kind of following this thread along, if you place a hire, six months goes by, and maybe, or even earlier, maybe it's 90 days, and you notice that they're not quite the fit that you thought they would be, do you advocate for coaching, or is it more of like, hey, this is, I'm going to give you a 2 weeks to kind of turn this around, and then unfortunately we have to part ways? Like, what is your strategy for kind of removing the B players, a B minus, if you will?
I have a very provocative strategy there, and that is lean into the discomfort, have crazy amounts of feedback. And this comes from a hard lesson. In the second company that we failed, Hire 360, that we raised friends and family money for, all three co-founders went from first failure to second failure, and we were working. That one failed, and we moved to a third company, and that started doing well. But the trouble was, one of my co-founders was not doing well. And I'll give you the short and sweet. He was a good friend of mine, friend for like 10 years, best friend. And yet I cowered it out. I was a bad leader. I spared conversations. And when I did have a conversation on feedback, I blunted my words and beat around the bush. And it came to a point where I had a mutiny. We involved a fourth co-founder, early employee made co-founder, I would say. He was a first hire and was awesome. We made a co-founder. And the other two co-founders mutinied. I was CEO. And so I got the whole, hey, it's either this, your buddy, or we go.
Oh, wow. Talk about a rock and a hard place, man.
Okay. It was awful. And I sat down to have a very frank conversation with my good friend, but I handled it poorly. I panicked halfway through. I said stuff I should not have said, and I ruined our friendship. And at the end of it, he left the company, and I don't talk to him. And that really hurts. And so loop back around on the employee side. I feel like that was one of the biggest indictments of my leadership. And my philosophy now is that you should never fire somebody and then be surprised. If they are surprised of getting fired, you have failed as a leader. You have to, on the very, very beginning, on the onboarding an employee, ground them with feedback, tell them what they're doing right, tell them what they're doing wrong. And if they aren't developing for it, you have to come alongside and tell them. And you need to explain to them where they're falling short. And here's the deal. I'll give you the tip. You can do this without being an a-hole. You can do this without being adversarial. You can do this by being a partner with them, by kind of almost metaphorically coming alongside, putting your hand on their shoulders and saying, hey, I believe in you. I hired you for a reason. I see these aspects of you that I really want to coach out, but you're struggling here and here and here, and it's lowering your effectiveness in the role, and I don't want to fire you. So let's figure out what needs to work. And you are very clear that firing is on the table, but you also make it very clear that that is way down there. We are going to work together, and we're going to make sure that you're 100% delivering, and that you're happy in the role, and that I'm happy with you in the role, and that you have autonomy.
That's amazing, man. And out of curiosity, if out of the percentage of when you have those type of feedback conversations, what percentage of people turn it around, and what percentage, unfortunately, don't make it? Have you noticed any data points there that you can share, or is it kind of nebulous where it's like it depends on the person and what the job role is?
It is definitely in case by case. I've learned to kind of almost have this rubric in my mind that if I feel like somebody has a 70% chance of turning it around, then yeah, of course I'll give them the shot to give lots of coaching and lean into that. There's two things you have to be aware of. I guess whether or not they can turn it around in your belief as like a leader, can they get to the skills that I need them to? And the second question is, can I get them there in the time that I need them to be without taking a ton away from me? And there's almost this thing where even if you could get the employee to improve, if it takes 9 months to do it, you have to probably fire them for that, right? Depends on the employee, case by case, but yes. What I did find though is, to answer another question here, is regardless of whether the employee did or did not turn it around, it solved the problem. There was a point where I had another guy that I hired at this, the turnaround company, Market Vision, and he was doing poorly. I loved him as a person. This is a guy I would have beers with and loved him. His name was also Alex. And long story short is that he was struggling as a leader, and I was having these coaching conversations saying, hey, you're good here and here and here, and I'm very impressed, but you're losing your people. You're losing your customer success team. And if you lose them, I can't replace a whole team. I have to replace you. And so I was working so much with him that, and he wasn't improving. It was still rough. But there was a point where it was in the middle of an all-company meeting that we do every month. I'd show him our numbers, and I'm very transparent with it. And I called on him, and he looked bewildered or scared. Later on that week was the week that I ended up letting him go. And he said, Alex, I was so scared that when you called on me that you were going to like publicly fire me. And he's like, honestly, you waited too long. This is a relief to have this conversation because I know I'm not doing really well. And as much as I was trying to, like, I'm not a fit here. It was almost a mercy kill for him because I was drowning him with so much feedback that even he knew. He was like, I'm not correct.
So what kind of KPIs have you integrated into your company that maybe aren't, like, let's speak about a little bit of innovative accounting from a lean startup side here, where it's not just dollars and cents and like lead conversions. Because if you're a salesperson, it's very easy to track how you're doing. I mean, it's like pretty much like how many appointments do you add, what's your conversions, what's your follow-ups. I'm tracking your client feedback. But what's some of the more, if you have a more nuanced role, maybe that's operation focused or maybe a development, what kind of KPIs on a high level, not getting too tactical where it won't apply to a broader business sense, that you've found success in with implementing on your teams?
You know, I am a big fan of like looking for KPIs that solve bottlenecks. And so every company is going to have different bottlenecks. Some of it's going to be on the bringing on customers and those innovation accountings of like your views versus click-through rates versus lifetime customer value. You have all those acronyms that go into that. And those are, you can look those online. The ones that I'm most focused on oftentimes is you have an equal problem scaling a company because you don't have the time to devote to it or your team doesn't. And so I'm a big fan of like KPIs that track delivering the service and how either efficiently you're delivering it or the quality of that delivery for it. And that can easily be after you have a service call at a customer for it too, that you just do a quick text with a thumbs up, thumbs down for it, whatever else. And those metrics, and maybe more sensitive because we have leaky buckets and we failed a couple of businesses because we did it. We brought a lot of customers. Very top of mind. Now I'm way more clear around like anytime I do a service, I immediately follow up with them and I try to have some really meaningful piece of a KPI or metric that says the customer is exuberantly happy or the customer is satisfied but okay. And those are areas of concern because I want to create raving fans. That is the way you really scale a business, where people start pulling your product instead of you pushing your product.
Oh, that's If you have your own clients start doing referrals for you, that's when you know you're onto something.
That's right. Those are raving fans, and you can do a lot to like accentuate that opportunity. But that is one of the most important like innovation accounting metrics that I consider.
Man, I wish we had more time here, but I would love to dive in. I know you have a hard out soon. I have two more questions because there's so much I wanted to speak about on AI. Of integrating what you just mentioned with KPIs. If I highlight tools, you can get instant feedback. There's amazing, amazing websites out there where there's AI tools that can integrate. But I know we don't have enough, unfortunately, enough time with that, but I would love to potentially dive into a couple of more philosophical questions. So we're going to do a little bit of a pivot here. So I know you mentioned that you have two children, right? You have a boy and a girl or two boys?
Yep, boy and a girl.
Amazing, so do I. And I know they're relatively young. What would you say you want them to be most proud of their father when they turn 18 and are legal adults on who you are as a person? And I'm not going to lead with like some answers here. I want to really know how you feel about it.
So there was, I call it my Walter White moment where
breaking bad, right?
I love it. There was a scene that really spoke to me, which is, when at the very, very end of the season, I'm spoiling some stuff, but if you haven't watched it by now,
it's been out a long time. You're good. Yeah.
Yeah. At the very, very end of the season, he's talking to his wife again, and he said, I did it for, she goes, I know the family. You did it for the family.
Right.
And he goes, no, I did it for me. And that was the first time, I get shivers every time I knew it. That was the first time he admitted to himself that it was because of his reason for it too. That characterized my first decade in entrepreneurship. My kid is 9. I have another 9 years with him until he's 18 now too. And I missed some very precious years for that. And he saw me working really, really hard. But I saw my dad working really, really hard. And I interpreted wrong lessons out of that, that your worth is tied to your work. And it is. What I want my kids to know about me and be proud of me at 18 is that I am, with balance, I do think that has to be part of it, with balance, pursuing my actual passions, but I'm in no point seeking identity or validation from those, because I have my identity and validation and things that are much more removable than a startup or than a company or than a sales figure for it too. And so they can grow up seeing ideally a father who has passions, but knows what's truly important and lives it.
So would you say family first, business second? And some people say business first. I've heard that before.
Yeah. I mean, I can see why people say that. How about this? I believe always family first and business second, but I didn't act like that. My actions betrayed me. And so that is exactly right. I want my actions now to be aligned with my actual beliefs.
You know, it's funny you mentioned Walter White, because there is a scene also on that show where he has to get a collection of meth to do a drug deal. Mm-hmm. And his wife is in labor at the time. And he's like putting all the meth in like a bag to get ready. And he gets a text message saying, your wife is giving birth. And he takes a second, pauses, and then he just continues putting the meth back in the bag and does the deal, and misses his daughter's delivery. So obviously that's an extreme example of business dedication, but it's easier to get caught up in the rotations of business and miss out and not realize how important that family time is.
So that's, you know, it's the little things though. It's the dinner that you miss or the meeting you prioritize
soccer
over
games,
the thing your kids at. It's those little things that add up to me where your priorities are.
And it's being that presence. I remember, so my father would attend our baseball games and he'd be there physically, but his mind was not there. He'd be on the phone speaking about a construction deal, whatever it is. And I still remember that as a 10-year-old boy, and my brother does too, of that absence of mind. And we go out of our way now as dads to make sure that that's not the same experience.
So I love that.
Yeah. So I'll end this with a question I ask every single guest on this show. If you could rewind the clock back to a younger Alex, someone who's in maybe in their early or mid-20s, who maybe is still going through that, fighting the demons that are internal that only you can see, what advice would you give that young man? And what advice can you give to the broader audience who maybe is going through a period of time that isn't quite right, or doesn't they feel like they're not on the right path?
You know, I'm going to retouch on that. There's something I learned a long time ago that I didn't live, but I wish I did. When that is, be careful where you seek your validation, because you give that object, item, wherever, equal power to invalidate you. And what that means is, no matter what, like, we all seek validation and identity from different things, but where we put stock in that gives power over us. And even the best things, like a company, like a church, like your wife, like your family, even, right? You can get validation on that, but they're all human and they're all going to make mistakes. And that means that you're almost going to be on this roller coaster alongside with it. And so what I wish I had done is to recognize that there is something much more important. And if the family's important, I am very fortunate. I've been married for 18 years this year, 19 years here in a little bit. It's crazy, but I'm very fortunate to have my marriage intact. And that has more to do with my wife than me. And I would tell people that, of like, even if you're hustling, even if you're putting stuff in, don't neglect the most important things, the relationships in your life, the people in your life, your family, your church, for it too. That is the support that you're going to need to go far with a venture.
That's fantastic, man. I really, really appreciate that sage advice. And I know that there's some deep value there. Alex, I cannot thank you enough for your time. This has been fantastic getting to know you a little bit more. And I think people need to, everyone needs a little bit of Alex in their life. And I'm sure you're getting a lot of attention is trying to draw you in on your time. So I cannot thank you enough for giving me an hour of your time here.
You are awesome. You ask great questions. Love this interview. Your readers and listeners are lucky to have you to like really dig into some of these harder, hairier things. Good work.
Thank you, man. And if someone wants to find out more about you, either know about the next tech venture you're launching, or maybe it's the next time you're going to be on the blocks, who knows? Where can they find out more about you, or I'll follow along on your journey?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, LinkedIn, and X, probably most actively. But if you want just a direct connection, alexg.consulting is my website. You can hop on there and hit any of my social channels, find one that you also follow. And then, yeah, reach out. I'm happy to do, I often do 30-minute like consultations with people where I don't just sit and ask questions. We workshop actual challenges and issues on the call on the very first time that I meet people. So if you have something you're running into, go to alexg.consulting. Ping me with a consult. I'm happy to help. Promise there's no salesmanship here. This, like, I can either help or I can't, and I'll tell you.
And I will vouch for that. You might be one of the most giving and most generous with your time business owners that I've ever met. So this is what you just offered is invaluable to a lot of people. So
thank
keep
you.
On keeping
that.
On, man. I know that you're on a journey of success. I hope to see you in person soon and just kind of hop along the train ride here. So thank you again,
Alex. Make it happen. Thank
yeah,
you so much,
Steve.
Thank you so
absolutely.
Much.
It's my pleasure. We'll see you on the flip side. Thank you for tuning into Service Business Success with Class. Are you craving more strategies to supercharge your business growth? You can connect with me at successwithclass.com or on my Instagram at StevieClass. And remember, when you hit subscribe, it's a win-win. You'll get your hands on all the latest tips, and you'll be supporting the show too. Thanks again for joining. Until next time.